Hi, Patrick Cox here, fresh from vacation land. We have a lot of brain talk today. This dreamy music fits quite well for that. Consider the case of a nun living in Morocco. She spoke French, she spoke Arabic. One day, she was in a traffic accident, she banged her head.
And after that, on one day, she could only speak French, and on the next day, she could only speak Arabic, and the other language had gone. On the days she wasn't using French, where did it go?
The answer, or an answer, is coming up. The World in Words podcast and the World Radio program are co-produced by the BBC World Service, Public Radio International, and WGBH in Boston. You can listen to The World, the big show, on any one of more than 280 public radio stations around the United States, or you can listen online at theworld.org. Go there to check out all of our other podcasts. I post show notes for The World in Words at theworld.org/language. There's also a World in Words Facebook group, and I'm also on Twitter occasionally. Just very occasionally. Today, street signs in Israel. You can only imagine how politically loaded they are. And a conversation with author Catherine Russell Rich on the many things that happen to your brain when you're learning a language. And finally, a slightly shameful sideways meal in Spanish. So, first, road signs in Israel. What's strange about this story is that it hasn't come up before. Or rather, I haven't noticed it before. I'm sure it's come up. Here's the deal. Road signs are trilingual. In Hebrew, English, and Arabic. But the country's new transportation minister wants to remove the Arabic and English names and replace them with Hebrew transliterations. And that's already been going on in an unofficial way, people climbing up a ladder and altering the signs. One couple, though, has been quietly trying to restore the signs. Here's reporter Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
About 6 months ago, Ilana Sichel from the D.C. area and her Israeli boyfriend, Romy Achituv, noticed something strange in their neighborhood. Many of the street signs had been vandalized.
This sign, see this? The slow sign? Yeah. That is off. That's been defaced in a couple areas.
You could still see the English and Hebrew names, but the Arabic translations were covered with graffiti.
And so it particularly stood out to us because it was such a blatant assault. There wasn't even an ulterior motive. I think the statement is that Arabs have no place in the city.
Sichel and Achituv suspect Jewish ultranationalists were responsible for defacing the Arabic. So they reported the vandalism to the Jerusalem Municipality Hotline.
The woman was very polite and very patient and wanted to know. She wrote down a long list of all the places.
But nothing happened. So Sichel and Achituv have taken matters into their own hands. They print out their own Arabic translations and get to work. It's a quick procedure. Pull up next to a sign, pull out the ladder, spray adhesive, and slap their sticker onto the sign, right over the graffiti that covered up the original Arabic. Some of their stickers have been torn down repeatedly, so they keep going back and putting up new ones.
You know, when people roll by, they never know what you're doing. They don't know if you're just hooligans who are out vandalizing.
You are a kind of hooligan, aren't you?
Maybe technically we're tampering with public property, but we're not touching any element of the sign that has not been tampered with before.
And we're just putting it back to its original state.
Which is why Sichel prefers calling themselves a
self-elected community maintenance crew.
On a few outings, police cars have passed by, but never stopped them. On this day, a driver pulls over to take some pictures of the crew in action. He says he likes their initiative, but offers some perspective.
If you see a hole in the road, you are not coming and fix it. Hole in the road, it's more danger.
That's true.
Still, Sichel says the initiative does serve a practical purpose for Arab residents navigating their way around the city who only speak Arabic.
If you're driving around in New York and the sign was blotted out, okay, where am I? You just don't know.
Achituv is doing it for more personal reasons. He grew up in Jerusalem and considers it home.
It's become almost like one of those chores that you have to do to maintain your household. That's sort of how I feel about it. So, you clean your house and you clean up your street signs.
At another busy intersection, boys driving by yell, lefties and disgusting. Achituv tries not to dwell on that.
What I would like to believe that we're doing is countering it by diffusing it. But I know that what we perceive as diffusion is counter-provocation on the other side.
As for Jerusalem's municipal government, it does consider the graffiti vandalism, but one official told me it's so widespread that they've essentially thrown up their hands. He said the city hasn't allocated enough funding for a major cleanup because it's not considered a top priority. So the vigilante community maintenance work continues, although with a change of personnel. Achituv and Sichel are passing off their project to some friends because Achituv is leaving Israel next week to work at a university in South Korea, and Sichel is starting a graduate degree in Michigan. This is their last day on street sign duty.
Wait, Ro, are you sure you don't want to turn down there? Because there's one to fix there. Watch out.
For The World, I'm Daniel Estrin in Jerusalem.
That was a little appetizer. Now on to the main course of this week's pod. Catherine Russell Rich has written a book that is a lot of things. This is what she did. She learned Hindi. It's a really difficult language to learn, and it's a weird choice because Hindi speakers here in the United States and elsewhere around the world, nearly all of them, speak English. Even in India, English is widely spoken there too. More on that in a minute. Russell's book is called Dreaming in Hindi, and it documents her attempts to learn the language. It's part travelogue, it's part memoir. You might even call it Oprah-esque memoir because there's the story of how Rich had cancer before she learned Hindi. And the language learning was tied up in that because she was looking to transform not just her body, but also her mind. In fact, the people on Planet Oprah noticed this. The book was chosen by O Magazine this summer as one of 25 books you can't put down. That said, the reason I was drawn to the book is because at each stage of Rich's language learning process, she asks herself, what's happening to my brain? And she turns to linguists for the answers. She asks them a lot of questions that, well, I've had, and maybe you too. Questions like, what's the difference between a child learning his native language and an adult learning her second or maybe third language? Or can you ever be truly bilingual if your second language is learned after you've mastered your native tongue? In other words, you're not learning both languages simultaneously as a child. Also questions like, why do so many language learners go silent for a while? And does acquisition of a second language result in the kind of infection of the first language? Maybe I'm making this sound a bit dry, but the way Rich answers these questions is far from that. Her narrative is chock full of stories, extraordinary stories in some cases. And they're stories that illustrate some of the latest neurolinguistic theories. And then, of course, there's Rich's own story. Here's an excerpt from Dreaming in Hindi. This deals with the low status of Hindi among many Hindi speakers. The setting is Rajasthan in India. Catherine Russell Rich has enrolled in a language school. But in the city she's living in, she's having a lot of trouble striking up conversations with ordinary Indians. In this excerpt, she tells a couple of friends about this. They're called Vikram and Mr. Acharya. And as you'll hear, they offer their explanations. The excerpt is read by The Big Show's Lisa Marlins.
I recounted how, the previous week, I tried to speak Hindi while buying a notebook. The elderly shopkeeper had stopped the transaction and commanded, "You speak in English." "But I need to practice," I insisted. "Okay, then. You speak Hindi, but I speak English," she said, and we proceeded haltingly. Vikram's face went black. "We don't want our own language," he cried, sounding as if he'd barked a shin. "We're living in a post-colonial hangover. We don't want our own languages." "English is the status language," Mr. Acharya agreed, and the ads for fast-track classes plastering Sector 11 came to mind. "Arena Multimedia, creating winning careers, ace computer education, first step for a successful career, all in English." The meaning was clear. If you knew only Hindi, or worse, Mewari, you could forget about a beautiful career. "Companies use Hindi as a line of demarcation," Vikram said. "Civil servants look down on people who speak it, but that's all they have, their ability to speak English. By exercising it," he said, "people were trying to show they're as good as Americans." Mr. Acharya nodded. "We can say we're better than the Chinese. Look, we can speak it and they can't," Mr. Acharya said. And for the first time, I began to understand I'd been plowing ahead naively. When I forced people into Hindi, I was signaling, in some minds, "You're not as good as me." "In Hollywood movies, Indians never speak properly," Vikram said heatedly. "The BBC puts subtitles on our politicians. That's why you're getting the response you are. Those people you're meeting are saying, 'Don't make me like that.'" Don't make me like that, a plea impervious to the argument, but your language is so beautiful. I'd tried, and for a while it seemed the Indians and I were operating at cross purposes. They were speaking English to separate themselves from themselves, and I was doing the same using Hindi. The real configurations, though, were more complicated. Among other reasons, the Indians, like everybody else, were using English because it was the global market language. But there was some truth to the equation, too. Foremost, the fact that I was speaking their language to divide myself from myself, though it would be months before I'd understand exactly what I was keeping myself from.
That's The Big Show's Lisa Mullins, reading from Catherine Russell Rich's Dreaming in Hindi. Rich actually began learning Hindi before she went to India. She was at a crossroads in her life. She'd survived cancer, as I mentioned before, but she hadn't survived the rat race of New York City's media world. She'd been a magazine editor there. So she started taking private Hindi classes. I asked her about that and how easy it was for her to practice her Hindi in New York City. Not surprisingly, given the status of Hindi, it was just as difficult, maybe even more difficult than it was later in India.
I was at the doctor's and I had my Hindi, speak Hindi book with me, my Hindi textbook. And an Indian nurse was very elegant and had a kind of British-accented English. She looked at it and she said, "What do you want to learn that for?" Very, like, disdainful. And I was a little surprised, but I thought, oh, I can maybe bat some Hindi around. And so I threw out some expressions and, like, "How do you like your job?" And she didn't answer. And she stared out the window. And then she looked around to see if anyone had seen me do that. And it was clear she didn't want to go there. And so I had opened a whole can of worms when I took that first Hindi lesson without realizing it.
Right. And you quote somebody who has an absolutely great line after that encounter with the nurse. Once you arrive in India and somebody says to you, "The first time I saw a Westerner speaking Hindi, it was like seeing a chicken barking."
I know. I love that. Was one of my teachers, Vidhu. He was talking about how he had become a Hindi teacher to English-speaking people, and he'd never seen a Westerner speaking English. And he said, "You know, I thought they all went around with their noses in the air, Westerners." And he demonstrated, you know, a stuck-up visitor with his nose in the air. And he said, "And so the first time I saw a Westerner speaking Hindi, it was like seeing a chicken barking." And that shock had actually propelled him through life working to teach Hindi to English-speaking people, because I think he felt such relief that there were actually Westerners who wanted to come in on his level. So he was, in fact, having a bit of the opposite reaction from what I was just describing.
So pretty soon, once you're in India, you've taken Hindi classes, but what you hadn't experienced before you started your immersion in Rajasthan was this disorienting sense, and you very much experience it through the language. So, for example, mm-hmm. you say in Hindi, the word for yesterday and tomorrow is the same word. The word for the day before yesterday, the day after tomorrow, again, the same word. And there's no words, Hindi words, for minute or second or appointment. Just they use the English words.
Yeah. That word meaning tomorrow and yesterday is Kal, K-A-L. And it comes from the word for the goddess Kali, who is death and destruction. So when you're in tomorrow or yesterday in your head, you're in blackness. You're not existing. It's only there when you're in Aaj, today, in a way. That's the philosophy that goes along with that. And it's also really embedded with beliefs in reincarnation. You know, you keep coming back to the same place now. You're reincarnated and reincarnated. So even just that little bit, it begins to change the way you think about things. And I did notice that there was I think a lot of people noticed there's a different Indian time sense than we have. I got there as a New Yorker where everything is scheduled, everything. People make play dates for their kids, and it's a breach of etiquette to call your friend and say, "What are you doing? Can I come over?" Because you're implying they're not important enough in a way to have their whole lives scheduled. So I got there and I kept trying to make dates with people the way you would in New York, and And they would kind of just stare at me that you would do this. Like, I'd say, what are you doing Wednesday at 10 o'clock? And they'd be like, I don't know. So even just that little word was a way of beginning to be pulled into this whole different world where time itself was different.
And did that make the language make more sense? I mean, as soon as you discovered the reason why yesterday and tomorrow is the same word, and everything culturally that comes with that, did that help you in sort of making a leap in understanding the language?
Oh, absolutely. You know, when I got there, I kept thinking, why is this so hard? And I had tried with French and Spanish, and it wasn't that difficult. And I began to realize, of course, learning a language isn't filling in the blanks. It's not trading your word for their word, and then you're speaking with a language like Hindi, which is from a culture so different. You don't just learn the word, you learn the culture in order to be able to speak. So every time I would grasp one of those things, it was a triumph and it was a leap forward. It's why I had a much easier time in the beginning learning Hindi with my teacher in New York who was not Indian. She got what I wouldn't know about India. It continues to this day. I study Hindi every week with a woman from Bombay, and she was saying last week, I said, how do you say excuse me again? And she said, well, you don't. We don't say excuse me. Not really. They have an expression, maaf kijiye, but that's very formal, like, please grant me your pardon. And so it started this whole conversation, you know, that went on for 20 minutes of, well, why don't you guys say excuse me? Why not? And I'm not sure we ever got to the exact bottom of that one. I'm not sure to this day why they don't and why we do.
And as you were learning Hindi over there, and presumably still to this day, I mean, you wanted to document what was happening, what might be happening to your brain. And so in writing the book, after you returned from India, you contacted a series of linguists, neurolinguists, and other experts who kind of helped you out with all of those different stages. Someone like Michel Paradis, the linguist from Canada, who studies bilingual people with, is it aphasia? Is that how you say it?
Yeah, aphasia.
Aphasia.
It's just any kind of injury to the brain that results in damaged speech.
Right, and he had these amazing stories of people who would flip between languages sometimes from one day to the next. What on earth is going on then? Why don't you just tell us a little bit more about the story?
Oh, I'm glad you're asking me about him, because of all the linguists, I could not get enough of his findings. And so he studies people who are bilingual, who've had some injury to the brain. He had a French Moroccan nun he was seeing, and she was riding in, let's say, Marrakesh on her motor scooter. She had an accident and banged her head. And after that, she could still understand her French and Arabic. But on one day, she could only speak French. And on the next day, she could only speak Arabic. And the other language had gone. And as he said, on the days she wasn't using French, where did it go? Where did it go? I thought, oh, this is some fanciful thing. But it's not. You can find thousands of these examples in medical literature. And so, Patrick, like, do you have other languages that you've, like, studied in high school?
I speak Danish I pretty close to fluently.
Oh, okay. So you could have an accident and your English could be wiped out except for kind of garbled speaking, but your Danish remains. And he talked some about the problems that causes, you know, if you're married and your wife doesn't speak Danish, you can no longer speak to your wife or your doctors. And the reason for why this happens to people, he thinks, and I think it sounds like a really solid theory, is he thinks that our second languages are processed in microscopic levels along different pathways than our first. And so therefore, if you had a stroke and your pathways for English got eradicated, you might still have your pathways for Danish.
So that is in the case of when somebody has learned one language first and then a second language later, rather than being raised to speak two languages simultaneously.
Yes, I think that it wouldn't happen if you, at an early age, had two languages, because you would have those early two languages processed in the same area of your brain. So they'd either all go or they wouldn't.
That's really, really interesting. You also tap into the research of what's called second language acquisition studies. So one thing that has been observed by these people is that when you're learning a second language, you go through a silent period. When does that take place, and what exactly is happening at that stage?
Well, it takes place early on when you get to the new country, and I got over there and I just stopped speaking, and I kept feeling so guilty that I wasn't trying my Hindi. And I just had this inclination to just listen. And then at about 3 months, I opened my mouth and my Hindi was like there. It just got there. So that was one of those times when I called a bunch of linguists and said afterwards and said, why would that be? And one of them in England said, oh, it's a documented stage that you go through. If you're smart with second language acquisition, kids do it. Like if you took your children to Paris for the summer, they would do that naturally. And she said they would get very quiet and then after a while turn out to be ages ahead of where you thought they were. And she said adults often try and fight it because we have strong wills and we want to express ourselves. And she said, but the best thing to do is just be in that silent period. I guess the theory is that during that time, well, you're kind of replicating what a baby, an infant, a toddler goes through when they're learning language. And so you're just taking it in and the language is setting. And one thing that goes along with that phase is, and I experienced, is you hear this chattering of the other language in your head all the time. You hear these expressions and sometimes you don't even know what they're saying. And it's just because your brain is absorbing all this stuff and assembling it, I guess. And during that time, I used to always dream in Hindi, but I couldn't understand any of it. It wasn't like I was having these great breakthrough dreams.
Oh, that's so funny. Dreaming in a language you don't understand.
Yeah.
I mean, I suppose you could almost say all dreams are like that, whatever language they're in, that you need, you know, someone to translate. But that's fascinating. And I really relate to the silent period the way that you described it, because that's exactly what I did when I first went to Denmark. I was silent for some time. Yeah. And then I at some stage, I felt, oh my goodness, there's this huge breakthrough. I started being able to have semi-sophisticated conversations with my friends. And, you know, I insisted at that stage that we speak in Danish. And it seemed to come out of nowhere like magic. But clearly it didn't.
Well, somewhere it was, you know, gone in your Chomsky brain or whoever's brain. It was happening. At that time, did you have the chattering sounds in your head with
Absolutely.
Danish?
Yes.
Yeah,
yes.
Yeah. It's wild that it's almost like our little brains know what to do with the second language, and we don't. You know, it's like they just go, okay, be quiet, and we're going to work.
Right. Yeah. And the older you get, the more our stubbornness resists that, presumably.
Mm-hmm. Were you frustrated during that time, or did you feel like you were giving yourself up to something?
I was a little bit frustrated because I was sort of there to learn the language, and I thought that I was being a little lazy in...
That's how I felt, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Your Hindi teacher in New York did divide her students into the analyticals and the globals as different types of learner, people who analyzed, or I think the implication was overanalyzed, and people who sort of sat back and let the language wash over them a little bit more.
Yeah, she's a wonderful language teacher, Gabriela Ilieva. She's Bulgarian, actually, and she speaks 13 languages. And she was the first encounter I had with a modern-day language teacher. And they've learned so much about how to teach people languages. And one of the things they've learned is that people tend to divide up into those two categories you just mentioned. And analyticals, they like to write everything down. They have to know what everything means. Why do you say it this way? Why do they say that? And they kind of trip themselves up because they're fuss budgets about language. And then you have the globals, and the globals are the ones who are willing to just plunge in, and they don't care if they make mistakes, and they, as you say, let it wash over them. So Gabriella determined quickly that I was an extreme analytical, and to the point I didn't really like to hear foreign language. I like to read it. I like to have it in writing, I think because I'm a writer and I like to read. And so the first thing she did to teach me Hindi was to forbid reading and force me to only listen to Hindi. And I thought I would die. It was so hard when I'd always had this other way of operating. And it was such a smart thing for her to do. And they'll do that now when they teach you a language. They work with your strengths and your weaknesses.
Taking away the script is incredible. It seems very extreme, but maybe you were an extreme case.
Well, she gave a test where she said, okay, take this list of words home. And they were words in English. And have a friend read them to you. And then you were supposed to write down the response you had. And I think swimming pool, you were supposed to say whether you saw it printed in your head or whether you felt a sensation of water. There were about four responses you could have to each word. And if you were a normal balanced person, you'd got like a third here, an eighth here. And every single response, I saw it spelled out. So she said, all right, that's it. You're not reading anything in Hindi, because she could see that that area of my brain was like way overdeveloped and was muscling away all the other parts.
Now, you also bring up the question of the second language, as you put it, cannibalizing the first one, which is just a great image. And also something I think for many people who've learned a language really can relate to that, that there's a sense in which you either forget the first language or it gets sort of eaten up by the language that you're learning because you're obsessing so much about that second language.
Yeah, that's another area where second language acquisition studies, they really are making a lot of strides in understanding things. And until recently, everybody knew about the phenomenon they call transfer. Transfer is just when you're trying to speak French and you're starting out, you will construct things the way you would in English. Your English is taking over the French just because you don't have the knowledge of the second language. And so you couldn't even say it's cannibalizing the French because there's not enough there to dine on, I guess. But it's transfer. You're transferring your English into French. But what they discovered fairly recently, and we're kind of surprised to find documented, is after a certain point, you're transferring in the reverse direction. So your French starts reshaping your native language. And they've found that people, let's say people who are native English speakers who speak fluent French, their English is actually a different English than their countrymen because it's been reshaped by French slightly.
And you found yourself doing that with Hindi.
Yeah, it still happens when I meet with Padmini every week. For about an hour after, I sound slightly Indian when I'm speaking English. And it's almost like the two, if the theory that we're using different microsystems in our brain, it's like the other one has gotten up and running and I'm slightly speaking out of that foreign language microsystem. But I remember in Hindi, people have this custom that I loved where instead of saying I am doing this, they say we for I. They'd say, you know, we will see you at 7. And they meant I will see you at 7. So I was talking to this expat friend in India and we were making plans and I said, okay, we'll see you at 6. And she said, who else is coming? She was like rattled. And I realized, oh, I'd adopted that part of Hindi had come into my English and was swimming around and I was just using that without thinking.
Oh, that's great. And did you ever put verbs at the end of sentences like Indians do? your example of that is to the house the mother the child is taking.
Yeah, that's, as you probably know, languages pretty much divvy up into three kinds. And in English, we have SVO, subject, verb, object. And in Hindi, it's SOV, subject, object, verb, is how the sentences are arranged. that's one of the first things when you're English speaker and you're learning a language like Hindi is you have to get used to what feels like you're falling backward every time you say a sentence and you have to construct it in your head. And it's not just a matter of you plop the verb down at the end. When it means a lot of the sentence gets rearranged. Instead of we have prepositions, they have postpositions. You really, like, going into it, I thought, how are these people doing this? How can they speak? And then you get used to it. You fall into those rhythms.
Catherine Russell Rich. Her new book is called Dreaming in Hindi. And now let's fall into a very different rhythm. Let's eat sideways, happily piling on the mixed metaphors here. Eating sideways is a slightly nonsensical rendering of a Japanese term, yokomeshi. What exactly is eating sideways? Well, for an explanation, and it is an explanation rather than a translation, check out The World in Words number 31. This week's barely translatable expression comes from listener David Scholl. Thanks, David. It's vergüenza ajena. And to explain it, here's The Big Show's William Troop.
Vergüenza ajena is a really interesting expression in Spanish, one that I haven't used much myself, but it basically means shame that you feel for someone else. Vergüenza means shame, and ajena means belonging to someone other than you. So it's a concept that is actually quite common in Mexico, where I'm from, which is that you take almost responsibility and feel for the things that other people are doing. You know, it's not your responsibility that somebody just dropped their tray with food, but you feel ashamed for them and you feel bad for them. It's something that is very common, for example, for someone to feel for members of your family. You feel kind of responsible for what they did. So if they do something bad, you feel shame for what they did. One way I was discussing this with my wife the other day, she speaks Spanish, and I was asking her if she ever heard of this concept. And she said no, but when I explained it to her, she said, oh, I know what that is. That's what you feel for George Costanza on Seinfeld when he does something bad that makes you cringe. You feel vergüenza ajena. You feel shame for him, even though you're not the one doing what he did.
Thanks, William. That's it for this week. See you on Facebook or Twitter or at theworld.org/language. I'll be back next week.